Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I am your host today, Benjamin Phillips. I'm joined today with Dr. Michael Roth, president of Wesleyan University. Dr. Roth, how are you today?
I'm doing well, thanks. Glad to be here.
Excellent. Dr. Roth, your recent book that we're discussing today is The Student, Short History by Yale University Press. How have you enjoyed working on this book?
Well, it's been an interesting process, actually. This is my third book with Yale in recent years, and I wrote a book called Beyond the University that they published in 2014, which is subtitled Why Liberal Education Matters. And that was a book I really set out to write. I was reviewing one of their other books in what they call the Why X Matters series, and so, well, wouldn't it be good to have a book on why liberal education matters, and wrote to an editor there, and then began working on a proposal for them. And then a few years later, did a book more on kind of political issues in higher education called Safe Enough Spaces, A Pragmatist Guide to Free Speech and Political Correctness and Affirmative Action. That was fun, but it was also things I'd been writing in the press. And then, well, along that, in that time period, an editor at Yale said that she had this idea. Her name is Jennifer Banks, and she's a wonderful writer herself. There's a new book out called Natality. She said she had this idea about doing a book on the student, and that I was the person to do it. So I wrote a proposal as an intellectual historian. My proposal was to try to look at this over a time, episodically, but still over a long period of time. And it was fun to write because I'm no expert on many of the things I'm writing about. So I was reaching out to colleagues and friends and saying, you know, if you have one book to read on medieval apprentices, what would it be? And sometimes their response was, I wouldn't ever do that. You know, it's just too big a subject. And others, at times, they were more helpful. So I learned a lot and you know, tried to write a brief history that points towards some issues in contemporary higher education.
Yeah. Yes, I'm sure specialists will be furious at various points. That is the job of the specialist. And
I guess so, yes.
It's the, I'm sure, you know, some academic book reviews of great book with the misfortune of mentioning my field.
When I wrote Beyond the University, you know, I'm a European historian, and my other work was in modern European intellectual history. And I told a colleague at Berkeley, prominent American intellectual historian, that I had written this book. And he said, I shudder to think of all the errors it will contain. And at least no one's found any errors. There may be people who disagree with it, but I'm sure that someone will find, as you say, something in their area of expertise that may not sit right, but did the best I could trying to write a book for a general audience about a subject people are really interested in. And what does it mean to be a student?
I thought it was quite good. Thanks for doing this and taking that on. So I guess diving into the work, you really do start at the very beginning with first chapter on iconic teachers and exemplary students, with Confucius and Socrates and Jesus. Why is it so important to lay our foundation here in deep antiquity?
Well, you know, I started thinking about what it means to be a student, and thought, well, it usually means you have a teacher, and then I thought of these figures who are these iconic teachers in the West and beyond, and I've been teaching a course on virtue and vice and literature, history, and philosophy for quite a while. I'll hope I turn it into a book in the next few years. But we start off with Confucius, and I've been teaching in these great books courses, either Plato or other ancient texts. And so I thought it would be interesting to compare being a follower, being an interlocutor, and being an imitator. Those are the only ways to describe the people who learn from Confucius, Socrates, and Jesus, and particularly around Jesus. Many people, of course, don't think of him primarily as a teacher. but I thought, what if we took it in that, we took them in that spirit, and I've just focused on a couple of their students, if I could put it that way, then maybe I could articulate these modes of learning. Being a follower, in the Confucian case, and there are some tensions around that. Like if you follow too closely, the master reprimands you. Being an interlocutor with Socrates, and although his students probably learn more from watching him question others than they may have learned from being questioned themselves. And then in Jesus' case, people who were called to imitate his life as best that they could, and to devote themselves to that, to the Christian project. So it was, it's a way of getting started. I mean, it's not a foundation in the sense that everything built subsequently is built on it. I wouldn't want to make, I don't know how I would substantiate that claim, so I don't exactly make it, but it is a way of orienting the reader to a wide variety of being a successful student. You know, you can be a successful, and is praised by your teacher, a follower of Confucius in a certain way, beloved by Jesus in a certain way, or profiting from Socrates' his questioning and his example.
Just as a matter of curiosity, these three are teaching primarily adults, grown men, already economically independent. Do you think that should affect in any way the way we apply these categories? I mean, this book primarily being about college-age students.
Yeah, well, I start off, you know, as you know, I mean, after that chapter, I deal with informal schooling in the pre-modern period. And by the end of the book, we're talking about college students. That's my major interest. But college students are neither fully adult, let's say, and not children. And so I do think that some of the issues that about teaching children are certainly removed when you're an adult learner. But putting yourself in the hands of a teacher, I guess when you're an adult, you're putting yourself in the hands of a teacher rather than being put by your parents or by some other forces into that teacher's orbit. But it surely matters what kind of student you are, according to when in life you become a student. So I've written a little piece, an op-ed that will come out soon about how when parents deliver their sons and daughters at Wesleyan, they often say to me, oh, I wish I could come back to school now because now I could really learn. Then I was too young to really appreciate all the opportunities for learning. And so I do think there's certainly different aspects of being a student that come out at different points in one's life. And that could be a whole nother book. You know, I mean, there are these programs these days for adult learners that are, you know, enrichment programs where people are not worried about building a skill to get a job. They're worried, well, they're trying to figure out how to live a more meaningful life. And that certainly, you know, it takes out the economic independence angle, which is an important one through a good portion of this book.
Yeah, that's good. And may those programs increase. If, you know, as you're saying, the main goals of college should be to make you a lifelong learner.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keep you in that way of life. I mean, you bring up at the end there that your chapter on pre-modern but not ancient education. Fascinating overview, by the way.
Thank you.
Very. You posit there that, like, the twin goals of education, particularly for non-elites, which is mostly what the chapter is about, are independence and social integration, which there's, you know, a tension there naturally. It's kind of at the heart of education, but how during this period are they seeking to manage that with these rising forms of education?
It's a great question. I do think that the goal for many families was to see their children being able to be economically independent, whether they got married into another household or able to set up a household of their own, to no longer be a burden on the parental household. But in so doing, to be integrated into a community, a village, a town, more rarely a city. And it's interesting that you detect a tension there, because for modern people, there is a tension that is, as an individual, we often think that, we often think of the individual as standing apart from a community, as independence being almost a radical autonomy. But not so in the pre-modern period, where being independent meant you were also part of a community. Not that that it was compromising your independence. You could only be independent within the context of a community. So you were, to use that old postmodern phrase, you were always already in a community, always already entangled in a community. And if you tried to break apart from the community to be independent, you probably couldn't survive, either because you needed their support or because they would kill you. Because you would be too, you know, if you were too wild, a anti-community member, they would be afraid of you and see you as a threat. We being moderns and postmoderns, you know, we often think of individuals as really, you know, like that libertarian vision of standing on your feet apart from anyone else. And I think that notion of personhood doesn't really become attractive to people until after the Enlightenment.
Right. Speaking of the Enlightenment, that raises the questions. It's just part of this narrative that we're dealing with this time period. It is, to some extent, it's an overdone question that everyone has to deal with, but everyone has to deal with it. So how do you see, you know, during this period of late pre-modernity or on the threshold of the modern era, as we have, you know, the Reformation and Renaissance changing what we learn and who learns and how they learn it, how do you think that is laying the groundwork or leading into the Enlightenment?
Well, I mean, I think there are, a lot of people have picked pictured this for us. I mean, part of it is certainly the increase in literacy that comes along with the Reformation and with, at the same time, in some places, the increased contact between and among villages and towns, so that in order to keep networks of communication open over greater distances than one had used before, you needed to be able to send messages and writing and basic arithmetic become more valuable for people as trade increases, contact increases. Reading the Bible, of course, becomes something that is inherently desirable after the Protestant Reformation for more people. And so before you get to the Enlightenment, there is also the technology, of course, of circulating texts with printing, and a developing curiosity about the world and its history that is met by or satisfied sometimes by being able to read about the world and its history. And so in the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, and then in the Renaissance, especially, in Southern Europe and elsewhere, there is a cultural shift. I mean, what is Stephen Greenblatt called it, a swerve, right, towards a culture that prizes literacy more than it had before as a vehicle for community cohesion, self-understanding, and making one's way in the world. So all of that, you know, is prior to the what we conventionally call the European Enlightenment in the second half of the 1700s, and definitely is a groundwork for it. Of course, still it's only a minority of people who can read. It's only a minority of people who are doing these things, but it's a growing minority. And it prepares the groundwork for the explosion of educational institutions that really is characteristic of the late 1700s and especially the 1800s.
And that really is kind of the core of your book is in, or the central argument of your book is in that time period. So you're right that, I mean, again, your central argument is Kant's late 18th century definition of the Enlightenment as freedom from self-imposed immaturity. Can you just unpack that a bit for us, what he means there?
Sure. So I've been teaching this essay, What is Enlightenment, for a long time. When I was a student, in those days at Wesleyan in the 70s, you know, we would have a seminar on Kant. We read all three critiques one semester. I mean, I don't know how that happened, but there it was. In my classes these days, I teach What is Enlightenment, and almost every year, certainly every year. And in the beginning of that essay, he says that what is enlightenment is freedom from self-imposed tutelage or immaturity. And what that means is that we keep ourselves dependent. We keep ourselves childish. We have ways of making ourselves irresponsible vis-a-vis authorities and vis-a-vis the world. And enlightenment is our moving away from that irresponsibility, that childishness, that failure to take responsibility for one's life in the world. And that it's a process, of course, for Kant, it should go slowly, not to, you know, don't rock the boat so much. To me, it's a definition that speaks to college age students. I teach this with college age students, who in some ways are extremely independent, and in some ways are very immature or dependent and fall back on childish ways. And so, that notion that through my education I should learn to think for myself, stand on my own feet intellectually. To not be a follower, but to be in some ways autonomous in relation to other people. And that seemed to me a great way of thinking about what successful student years are like, that you learn, and it happens, it can happen for the rest of one's life, and you learn, yeah, gosh, I'm still following something that I've never interrogated about myself, that I was taught when I was, I don't know, 20 years old. And now I'm thinking, why do I believe that? And that you're freeing yourself from your automatic obedience to something that you haven't fully considered. And freeing yourself from automatic obedience to something you haven't fully considered is a form of freedom that comes by being a student.
Right. Very good. Do you see in that the potential for not so much a rejection of what you had automatically believed, but a more mature and self-conscious appropriation of that?
It certainly can be. I mean, sometimes these things happen in waves, right? You know, you might first reject and then reconsider, you know, that your automatic would be a form of obedience.
Yeah. And so as this way of thinking is going on and spreading, I mean, you can't even kind of towards the high enlightenment, this is changing the institutional framework of it too, right? And so we have birth of the research university and the development of a different kind of campus culture. It just becomes more normal and accessible. But with that, as you have more people, you have to have more ways of distinguishing, and so you have student types emerging. You write at this point, though, in the next chapter from Kant, that the goal shifts, and it's no longer in the Kantian mode to arrive at independence and maturity, but to delay that arrival for as long as possible. How did this kind of take place after the high enlightenment?
Well, I think what happens is not so much a goal of delaying the process. I guess delaying the arrival is accurate enough. But that in the 1800s, you have the development of modern schools, which are aimed at giving people basic skills so they could participate in the nation state and the economy, and so in places where there's increased percentages of inhabitants of an area voting, that they are able to make informed choices. That all happens as you know throughout the 1800s, and in some cases in a very dramatic way, like in France in the second half of the 1800s, very centralized education. But during this period, and this, I write about this in the chapter to which you refer, there is the development of the research university, and most importantly, from my perspective, the research ideal, which is not to discover the truth with a capital T, but to engage in a process of learning that will have no terminus, that learning will lead to answers, but those answers will lead to more questions, which will lead to more a continuation of the process. And that the notion of Bildung, as Humboldt and others developed it, was one of inquiry, of being the foundation of studenthood or studentness, that you learn to be someone who inquires, which is different from being someone who perfects their skill or learns simply how to, you know, make enough money to survive or prosper. That you learn to be someone who has an appetite for inquiry, and that inquiry will go on. And that's a good thing. So in the German universities, American tourists and visiting students are quite surprised that students have all this freedom to go to the classes they want to, they could do it, and they act out, you know, as young people do. I mean, I write about the American fascination with German dueling, the German university students are getting drunk and having sword fights, and the kind of proto-fraternity culture we can recognize. But in Germany, the goal is like, yeah, they're going to do that stuff, but eventually you're going to have to ask your own questions. And then you find a teacher who asks questions that you think are productive. And you continue to ask questions. You don't find a dogma that ends questioning. Your goal is to find modes of questioning that help you get along in the world, and whatever that means to you. And that notion of an institution that doesn't just provide dogma and doesn't just provide skills, but provides an ethos of inquiry, that I think is at the heart of liberal education in the United States in the 20th century, when it's at its best.
Right. So you mentioned the sterile dogmas that prevent inquiry, and you also discussed earlier the pitfall of an extreme Socratic irony that just distrusts and everything, and that never has any actual commitment and content. Do you think this research ideal kind of recaptures that? I mean, as Aristotle says, you know, the philosophy begins with wonder. Do you think this is a more just institutional form of that?
Well, it's certainly related to that. I mean, I think that Aristotle, as you say, this philosophy begins with wonder, but then it goes on to do this kind of detailed work of trying to understand the world around you, whether it's the ethical dilemmas or the basic physics of the world around you, and that so you don't wonder leads to inquiry. It's not the same thing. I have this conversation with my students every year. I teach my virtue class, right? And what do they think is wonder? It's not the same as curiosity. It's not, it's related, but curiosity is more pointed and aims to be answered. Wonder is more reverent, perhaps, and more there's an element of surprise and delight. All of those things are important in inquiry, but inquiry also, you want to know how to make a better cup of coffee. You could try different things, and not everything will be, some will be better than others. And I think that the important part of the inquiry is it can be productive without having a terminus. You may not know what the ideal car is, but you can tell when your car is running better than it was yesterday when it was broken down. There are people who say, well, that's because you have a notion of the ideal car in your head. Maybe. I think it's more that you have a notion of what you want to do next, where you are now, and you try to find strategies and tactics to get there from here. And inquiry is the way to do that rather than dogma.
So speaking of just as universities rise and proliferate, we have questions, coming into the 19th century of racial integration and women on campus, and then the GI Bill, just these massive shifts to the load that universities take on and the cultures that are present. How are these impacting or even reflecting earlier shifts in the idea of the student?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I spend quite a bit of time in the book on the problem that slavery posed to Enlightenment figures, because on the one hand, they say, everybody should be able to learn, stand on your own 2 feet, get rid of self-imposed maturity, but not Black people. They can't do that. Because there's enslaved people. And so in order to justify this extraordinary oppression of people because of the color of their skin, they come up with all kinds of ways to show that Black people can't learn, can't be students. And of course, many people show the idiocy of this point of view and the tortured contradictions that the thinkers get themselves into. And over time, of course, with the eradication of slavery, there's the recognition that one of the characteristics of human beings is the ability to be a student. Well, what about women? you know, then there's what about immigrants? And then, you know, and so throughout the second half of the 1800s and into the 1900s, the questions of how best to build a community of students, those questions arise with real force. And so you find schools going through all kinds of steps to try to say, we want independence and integration, to go back to that part of the book. And that means we need integration. It's only some people will integrate in a community. We can't have women in our community because the men won't be able to learn if there are women around, we can't have black people in our community because they will corrupt the community because of their racial inferiority, or we can't have Jews in the community because they will never integrate successfully. I was just listening this morning to a podcast called The Gate Crashers about the amazing things that Columbia University did to create barriers to Jews getting there. And it was because they wanted a community. And, you know, in order to be in a community, you had to be Protestant and you had to be a guy. And so all these Jews were showing up and saying, hey, we're guys. And we got good grades. And then I said, well, it's not just grades. It's like, you know, big part, it's like singing. It's like, so we can sing, you know. Well, it's not just singing. It's, you know, and then it became all of these barriers created in the name of community, but it's like, it's in the name of excluding people from your community. And through the course of the 1900s and then in our own century, these barriers to entry have been reduced, not eradicated clearly, but dramatically reduced. And the goal of having a community of inquiry has been tarnished by the racist, anti-Semitic, and sexist ways people try to maintain the community. But I don't think the goal of having a learning community is wrong. It's to say, how do you have a community and also promote access to it? And I think we're wrestling with that now. I mean, this summer I decided that Wesleyan would no longer privilege applicants to the university whose parents went here. And for some schools, that's like a big deal. They won't give that up because it's in the name of community. But, you know, what I think we've seen in the course of the last 100 years or so is that you can have a community of inquiry without the kind of barriers that keep certain kinds of people from participating, from being part of the conversation and part of the learning experience.
And in kind of related to that, and definitely in time, but I think also in theme as well, you have kind of the rise of student activism in the 60s, kind of the hallmark of that time. I mean, it's still definitely continuing because a grad student at Ohio University, I could definitely attest to that. How does that come up? And do you think that that is an extension of, you know, being a student and that liminal space of integration, or a distraction from the learning community?
Oh, I think it is characteristic of being in this liminal space. It's characteristic of being in a place of inquiry where you don't take things on authority. The nature of student activism changes over all periods of time. I mean, you could call the dueling in German bars kind of activism or acting out, but it was not political, but it was anti-authoritarian. It was thumbing their nose at the authority of the university. In the first half of the 20th century in the United States, well, even before that, you know, there were a lot of student protests, but it was mostly protests so they could party more. You know, we want to have more rights to drink or more rights to duel or, you know, shoot guns off in the dorm. And you know, students bridled at being treated like children by their professors. At a time in the late 1800s when the students were wealthier than their teachers, typically, you know, they're not going to take orders from people they would otherwise order around if they weren't on the campus. So that into the post-World War I era, is a kind of anti-authoritarian dimension of student activism. When you get to the post-World War I era and subsequently, students are also a laboratory for radical ideas. I mean, this had happened before that too. But it really, from the 1920s through the 1960s, especially on college campuses in the United States and in certain European cities, student groups, sometimes with the help of professors, become laboratories for exploring alternative visions of how we should live together. And this becomes very powerful in the 1960s, partly because of the dramatic increase in just the sheer number of students who are in college, and of course because of the Vietnam War, when students, if they weren't in college, would have to go serve in overseas in a war that was incredibly unpopular and was built on lies and injustice. We now know it is built on fabrication of information to the public. But at the time, students were rejecting a society that they could reject from the campus because they were protected in the campus in a way, most of the time. And the massacre of students at Kent State and killings elsewhere showed that they weren't as protected as they might have thought. But with the decline, with the end of the Vietnam War, certainly there is a decline in student activism in the 70s, and now it kind of percolates at various institutions in different ways, but not with the same general intensity that it had in those days, for sure.
Right. That's very helpful context. Thank you.
Yeah.
So you kind of get to this at the end, but your programmatic statement being that college should prepare them to thrive by instilling and creating these habits of mind and spirit that develop, like you said with Kant, over the lifetime through the process. What do you see, especially as someone who's, been in the university context for 50 years and is a president now, what do you see being the main obstacles towards developing those habits for modern students?
Well, there were just dramatic economic obstacles that affect student life on college campuses all over the world, but I'm most familiar with, this country. And we live in a society where economic inequality weighs heavily on everybody who's a student and who's, older than 15 or something, that there is a pressure not to be an economic loser. That is very different from when I was an undergraduate in the 70s. When I was thinking about graduate school, like today, there were no academic jobs. I mean, I was told my advisors who liked me and was there, they said, don't go to graduate school. You'll never get a job, they said to me, an academic job. And, go to be a student, but you'll never get a job. It's just no job. And at the time, I was, my parents didn't go to college, and it was a sacrifice financially for them to send me to school. And I said to them, should I, I don't know what to do. I love studying everything. And I was lucky to get a fellowship to go to graduate school, but I wasn't sure if it made sense, if I should start working. And my father at the time said, you can always make some money. He said, your uncle's a cab driver. He can fix you up. You can find a way to make money. I worked in the kitchen when I was a student at Wesleyan. He said, if you don't try, you'll never know whether you should have tried. So if you didn't try and you fail, no big deal. I don't think parents have that attitude now. I think they feel like if you try and you fail, you're doomed. if you're not making a gazillion dollars, you're making zero, which is not true, but certainly it is more true than it was that middle range of professions is just harder to access harder to live with, make or support yourself with. So I think that keeps people from exercising this learning as freedom. I think good old American anti-intellectualism is in there too. I mean, there's an understandable reaction against elites right now in the United States. It's very easy to attack elites if you're a leftist or on the right. Everybody attacks elites, and because inequality is so dramatic, anti-elitism is powerful, but that means that lots of students don't believe in their professors. They don't believe in the institution, or certainly lots of Americans don't believe that college is worthwhile as they did before. And the growing distrust in institutions has led to a growing distrust in colleges and universities too. And I think that partly I wrote this book to argue for a more idealistic notion of being a student. And it's not being a leftist or conservative or whatever. It's about embracing inquiry as a form of freedom. And that this is a good thing, whether you're a religious person or a secular person, whether you're a technology person or an elementary school teacher, that, living a life that puts inquiry in the middle of it, is a life through which you can develop your capacities, and that's a wonderful life to lead. It doesn't mean you don't have to worry about skills, because we do. You need skills, and it doesn't mean you don't have to worry about material things. You do have to worry about them, but I think that this joy of inquiry is something that one experienced, one really prizes and should prize, because it's important for the individual and it's important for democracy, in which people are supposed to choose their leaders, to be able to engage in inquiry to decide who should be governing us, and to work with your neighbors and fellow citizens to choose the people who will lead our communities and cities and country. So I think it's very important not to leave inquiry behind in the service of just skill building, because I think that that attitude of inquiry and conversation and engagement is vital for us as individuals, but also as citizens.
Yeah, Ben. Thank you. That's a wonderful call for our times. Intervention in the state of things right now. I know I really appreciated the work. I've had some of your lines ringing in my words as I prepare my this week. So this book, again, is from Yale University Press and will soon be available there and many other places. Is there anything else you're currently working on that we can be looking forward to?
Well, I'm starting to work on this book on virtue and vice. And the first chapters are on Aristotle and Confucius. And next up is Aquinas. I'm sure I'll make lots of mistakes. And then eventually I'll get to contemporary writers and thinkers. And my interest there is to chart the course from the idea of virtue as a strength to virtue as a vulnerability, and then the rise of the thinking about virtue as linked to suffering, really, in our own time, and trying to offer an alternative account of being virtuous that's not so grounded in having suffered or being a victim. So I have a lot of work to do, but I think in the next few years, I'll get to it.
Sounds fascinating. Look forward to it.
Thank you. And thank you for your good questions.